I'm John Krall. The election now is just 12 days away, and the candidates for national and state offices now are bombarding voters with last-minute appeals. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a look at the target of those appeals, the folks who actually cast the ballots. We're going to talk about what really influences voters. We'll talk about this with a great group of guests. Butler University political science professor Terry Jett, former Indiana House Speaker Paul Manweiler, now with Bose Public Affairs, and author Audrey Borchel. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about what really influences voters. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I'm joined by a great group of guests today. Starting with Terry Jett, who is a Butler University political science professor. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
This
it's
is like
to be
your
here.
Third time, right?
It is.
You're
I always enjoy
now.
Being here.
You're a veteran now. Paul Manweiler, who is the former Speaker of the House, the Indiana House of Representatives, and is currently with Bose Public Affairs. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Audrey Borchel, who is the author of Sleuthing the Truth, in the media, whoever wrote that title did not work in radio. That sleuth and truth, I know I'm going to mess that up at some point during this hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. Well, I think probably we ought to start, since we were talking about this off the air a little bit, that there is kind of an elephant in the room. When we planned this, we really did not plan to have a news hook this size for this program. But clearly, Indiana now has become sort of the center of a national media and political controversy, in regard to Richard Murdoch's statements about abortion and rape. I'm not going to ask us to weigh in on whether that was right or wrong. I'm going to ask a more basic question, which is that the sort of stuff that voters do care about, or is this something that political and media types focus on more? I'll start with Terry Jett.
Yes, first I'm going to qualify my answer by saying I am a member of the Indiana Debate Commission, and I was actually present at the debate when that statement was made. And I would like to also offer that the questions that are posed to the candidates come from the public. Mm-hmm. And so the Indiana Debate Commission does represent the public to that extent, and it allows for candidates to be able to express their values and their ideas to the public directly. And so it is an important issue that some voters are concerned about. Some voters are one-issue voters. I don't believe that that's the case for most people, but that is something that a lot of people are concerned about, so which is the reason why his statement got a lot of attention, because it was perceived as being rather extreme to some people, and the media just picked that up and sort of ran with that, and it gave Indiana some attention, which I think we deserve anyway.
Paul Manweiler, is this a media or political firestorm, or is it something that people would really care
well,
about?
Well, I think it's a combination. I guess from my experience in politics, abortion was one of those things that was very personal, and to a great extent, voters did not want to discuss it either way. Mm-hmm. They had their own personal feelings, and they applied it at the ballot box. The fact that this has become such a large deal is to a great extent because the closeness of the Senate election, the closeness of the presidential election, and I think obviously for political reasons, people that are maybe not in first place or view they're not in first place want to leverage this statement. So I think it probably comes as much from the politicians as it does the public.
Well, Audrey Borchel, I'll toss it back to you in that regard. Is it something you think people care about, this issue, or is this one of those things that actually alienates?
Some people will care about it very much as a single issue,
mm-hmm.
and they won't consider voting for someone who is perhaps more open to different measures. Perhaps in this case, Mr. Murdoch just didn't compose his words well enough, and therefore they hit at the extreme. Because I believe that politicians can be honestly expressing their feelings, but this wasn't a very inclusive statement and could have alienated a lot of the women who were listening.
Well, and I'll take it back, since I may be mistaken, but I think, Paul, you're the only one who's held elective office, right, on our panel. And I interviewed you, obviously, when you were the speaker, and I was a newspaper reporter that time. You got a lot of people talking to you, and then in the course of a campaign, you're going to have to answer an awful lot of questions, and know that people are listening to you each time. Is this part of a kind of gotcha culture or whatever that we hear people talking about an awful lot, and then frankly Audrey alludes to a little bit in, mm-hmm. in her book, where you think, okay, I'm just a human being, you know, not everything I say is going to be a gem.
Well, and I think that's true for 95% of the people. Some people just seem to have a golden tongue and know exactly what to say all the time, but I think that's part of what we're seeing. My understanding is the libertarian, who obviously would be very pro-choice because he doesn't want government involved, made the statement that he didn't really think it was, as bad as it was stated. He didn't really mean that, and he was obviously somebody sitting there among the three candidates. But it's the kind of thing that I believe the media projects, and to a certain extent, because it's like most other media issues, people, you can excite some people about it. Mm-hmm. And consequently, I think that's part of the reason it's gotten the coverage it has.
Well, let's then shift this conversation a little bit. We've agreed there is some, this might influence some voters, but not all of them. What things do voters really care about? I'll keep it with you for a second, Paul, since you're the one who actually has had to campaign for people's votes. What were the things that you found that they really, really cared about?
Well, I obviously the most important thing to everybody is their own particular situation. Mm-hmm. I think everybody normally votes their own pocketbook, votes their own vision of who they think they are, where they want to be in life, what they want to do, and what their expectations are. So, everyone to a great extent this year, I think far and away, it's the economy, it's jobs. That's normally one of the top things, but sometimes at the state level, property taxes might come up to be a job, a real question. Economic development might develop into a question. Education, certainly, for individuals who have children in school, education is extremely important. But really, all of society ought to be concerned about education, because those of us around the room here approaching retirement, if you don't have an educated society, it's not going to be a very good society for everybody. So, I think different issues move different people, and to a great extent, the voters sort of synthesize those all together into what is important to them when they look at the candidate.
We're talking about what influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. What Paul was talking about, it's many elections, and the presumption, the conventional wisdom, is that pocketbook issues tend to drive elections. Is that always the case? Terry Jett?
I believe that that is largely the case, but initially people are socialized to think along certain political lines and identify with, in this country in particular, with certain political parties based on their own family background and the values that they are basically raised with. And so that's a good portion of it. And not too many people will move away from that too far as they go through life. It depends on what they experience, the education that they gain, where they come from initially. If they move and live in different areas, there's a lot of different things, the types of experiences that they will have. And so, yes, all of these factors will weigh into it. But I think it does boil down to where an individual and their family is at a particular point when the election cycle does come around. And a lot of people will be so disenchanted with politics that they will simply check out of the system, whether they're doing it as a political statement or whether or not they feel that it actually makes a difference. And so there's so many things that weigh into that. These days, I believe largely it is the economy, because so many people are going through a lot of different changes. There are a lot of things that we are concerned about throughout the world that we are involved in. And so it's really hard to pinpoint what exactly it is that is driving voters. And I've read recent studies that said it depends on whether or not their peer groups are mm-hmm. voting, mm-hmm. that people will go along with what's popular mm-hmm. And make their decisions that way. So, yeah, there's a lot weighing in on that.
Well, and I'm going to stay with you for just a second on this, because the cliche often is that, you know, people don't always vote their interests. They'll vote their aspirations. Is there some truth to that?
Well, yes, and I would actually hope so. I think, you know, I hope people that are looking towards the future and thinking positively and also being concerned not just with themselves, but concerned with the collective interests of the community and also the nation. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. And they also need to understand the way the system works, that things develop incrementally. And so to expect an instant change as a result of an election is not really going to happen. So people do need to kind of think towards the future when they're voting.
We are talking about what influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. David, welcome to the program.
Welcome.
Good to have you here. Your question, please.
Well, I'm just, I guess it's more of a comment. I just have a concern. We have Senator Murdoch, or I guess candidate Murdoch, saying that he believes that, you know, if someone gets impregnated as a result of rape, that it's intended by God. And if that's the case, then why not stand on that? I guess my comment to what you've been talking about is, why are we so afraid, or why are politicians so afraid to say what they really believe? And then let's have a debate on what they really believe, instead of if there's a political or public outcry, then all of a sudden they didn't really mean what they said. I just would like your guest to comment on that.
Thank you very much for the. I guess it is a statement more than a. Well, there is a question posed in there. Thank you very much for the call, David.
Sure.
Well, I'll toss it to you, Audrey. Is that and that is a fairly frequent complaint that, you know, these campaigns are never about anything that's real, anything that anyone would care about.
And I think that Mr. Murdoch was trying to be real in his sense of truth and honesty for himself. And that's very important, because a lot of times we get a flip-flop of what is said. If it works well in this situation, that's fine. And if it changes, it needs to change because a different public is assessing the person, that's true too. Abortion is an out issue. It's the kind of issue that triggers all kinds of emotional feelings in people, and it's among the issues.
Well, and I'll toss it to the, as they say, the recovering politician over on our panel here. Why is it that, you know, that is the complaint, but make the other argument, obviously, for why politicians do kind of have to measure their words?
Well, a politician obviously can't get elected without 51% of the voters, so that is normally somewhere in the equation. You know, whether Richard Murdoch said exactly what he meant to say, I think all of us would probably sit here and say it didn't come out the way maybe he wanted it to come out. But, I mean, this might be a good example for the questioner's approach, why doesn't somebody just stick with what they say? I mean, here's a case where he's getting grilled pretty badly and may or may not affect the election because of one statement that came out in a debate. And that's, you know, the way it is many times. Well, I'm sure we'll get into this, but many times I left the legislature at midnight after we'd been in session for, you know, 12, 14 hours. We'd voted on important education matters, important economic development, important insurance, et cetera. And maybe there'd been a resolution making sugar cream pie the Indiana pie of the year or whatever, and that was in the paper the next day. And you'd sit there and go, what did I just do for 12 hours that this is the main thing people are going to hear about? So a lot of it is how it's projected, how it comes across, and you know, in today's world, 30- and 60-second commercials.
We are talking about what really influences voters here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about what really influences voters. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Terry Jett, who is a Butler University political science professor, Paul Manweiler, who was once Speaker of the Indiana House of Representatives and now is with Bose Public Affairs, and Audrey Borchell, who is the author of, I'm going to try to get through this again, Sleuthing the Truth in the Media. Well, we've talked a little bit about what it is that, you know, voters are looking for. What is it that turns voters off? I mean, we see an awful lot. Terry Jett, I think, mentioned that there are people who just disengage entirely from the process. Mm-hmm. Audrey Borchell, I think I'm going to start with you. What is it that creates the disconnect?
I believe the negative ads certainly are one part of that. Repetitive negative ads, because they drum into people certain feelings that maybe it isn't all that bad on the end. I think people are indoctrinated by a lot of these ads and they can't shake them, mm-hmm. that they believe what they read, hear, see, and can't get past it.
Yeah, some of these make it like, why are we even letting this person walk around loose?
You know? Yeah, and it's very difficult. And I think a lot of people get fed up with that. There doesn't seem to be much civility in the campaign process.
And is some of that, and I'm going to go to Terry Jett on this one, there is a calculation, you know, political professionals, if you get them away from a microphone or off the record, will say there are times that they really don't like undecided voters because they, by definition, they're a variable. And one of the ways you do chase them out of the process and make it just about, you know, getting your team to the polls is by doing a lot of negative advertising and turning people off, so it just becomes a get-out-the-vote effort. Is that a fair assessment, and what impact long-term does that have on the process and on voters?
Well, I happen to think that the negative ads are just do a disservice, actually, to the political process. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I've seen recently that I think is really difficult to swallow, one ad I was looking at referring to constantly calling Donnelly a liberal, for example. And if you're someone, a voter, that actually hasn't really followed the positions of your representatives, then you might actually think that that's the case. And these terms that are thrown around to cast aspersions on various people are certainly problematic, especially for the voter that doesn't have the time to really do the research and find out what candidates really stand for and also to follow their records. And so it's definitely a problem. And we don't want to have elections decided on 25% to 30% of the population actually voting. It does a disservice to the entire country and to the community. So, yeah, it's a problem, definitely, that we need to try to figure out a way to move away from.
But again, and I'll go to the recovering politician on our panel, Paul Manweiler. You know, at least the cliche in political circles is the negative ads move the numbers. That's why they're there. Is that the case?
Well, I think that's accurate. I mean, everybody hates negative ads, but it does seem to be effective. You know, there's a reason. I mean, obviously Indiana's not a state in play this time, so we haven't had a whole lot of advertising at the presidential level. But friends of mine in Ohio and Florida and different places have told me they're so sick of the ads. Mm-hmm. And during that sort of June to August period, I mean, President Obama, almost everything was negative about Romney. He tried to define his opponent before the opponent could define himself and did a very effective job and might be one of the reasons he's still leading in a lot of those swing states, because he defined Romney so negatively that it was difficult to dig out of that hole. I guess we'll see all that, you know, as people do the analysis after the election. We know who wins, we know who really voted, but I think there are, you know, millions of people that just get, I mean, a friend of mine in Ohio said she was so sick of ads in July. I mean, they were just inundated in political ads.
Yeah, it's like for Ohio, Florida, Colorado, it's been pretty much like we have seen with Murdoch and Donnelly for the past few weeks, but that way since the beginning of the summer. We're talking about what influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on.
Certainly.
One of the biggest issues for me is this insurmountable deficit that we have. And I've tried to do my own research and try to figure out which party has the best strategy. And I'm struggling with that. How can we decipher, you know, which is a good plan, which will actually achieve the desired results? If your panel could guide me on that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the question, and I suspect we'll give it our best effort, but I think probably we could spend the next 4 years on that one.
Right, I agree.
Thank you very much for the question. Well. And I'll start with, I think that's that, if I'm going to reframe David's question just a little bit here, it would be, you know, that's a big issue. And one of the other frustrations about political campaigns is often the big ones, the ones that are hardest to solve, are the ones that the process just does not engage with. Audrey Burchell, you're nodding your head. So
I agree with that, because the big vital issues seem to be insolvable. I mean, they haven't been solved in the many years that politicians and others have been trying to work on them. And when we blame one party or the other for not solving them, it may not be because the one party doesn't have the information or the wherewithal to do it. It's just that it's going to take time. It's not an instant measure to come up with solutions. And, you know, we can just refer back to the last 4 years of what has worked, what has been done. And then Mr. Romney, as the opposing candidate, probably has a whole slew of solutions to bring in and develop and try. But there's been a lot done and a lot attempted.
Well, and I'll take that to Terry Jett and engage with the substance of the question, but also pick up, I think, on point you were making about negative advertising and moving us further away from these solutions. Does it help that, you know, to some degree negative ads are about creating caricatures of your opponent's positions, and then we're stuck with kind of those caricatures when it's time to sit down and attempt to solve this? Do they impact the process more than we might think?
They do, if the voters do not do, as the caller just said. I mean, he has done some research, and it is incumbent upon the voter to educate themselves, to read the party platforms, because the candidates are representing the parties, and they have to be able to articulate those viewpoints. So it's not just their own personal ideas and values that they're standing on. It has to be what their party believes in and what they're going to be able to push through the legislative process. And so to understand how we are going to be able to, for example, move out of the deficit, you have to look at the party platforms and see where the priorities are and where the money is being spent. Now, if you happen to believe that we are spending too much money on the military, for example, mm-hmm. that has added a tremendous amount to our deficit, then you might consider, well, which party is looking at that area mm-hmm. as a source of doing some reductions and to address the deficit, because that has been a large part of what has happened in the last, you know, 8 years, 12 years, actually, with regard to why we have a deficit, along with some of the other things that have transpired economically. So it's a matter of understanding the priorities of the political parties that are being represented by the candidates, and then understanding how they will be able to then move their priorities and reach across the aisles and cooperate. For example, the voters might want to look at why we do not have a farm bill, mm-hmm. and that might give you some mm-hmm. sense of where our priorities are.
We're talking about what really influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is the fact-checking with the ads, the negative ads that are run, that I find, I don't own a television, but I do listen to the radio, and then I get it from online, is the fact-checking is not there. I mean, take the money that's spent on this campaign, this just because of what's happened with the Supreme Court, and put it towards the deficit. I meant most of it has been smoke and mirrors, and the news agencies aren't, their feet aren't held to the fire that when these ads are run to counter the facts that are in the ads, because obviously either side is not going to correct themselves.
Good question. I'll throw that one to Audrey Borchel. Thanks for the call, Mike.
I've actually seen several articles that have tracked the facts in the debates and even before that. And they're pretty good with catching some of these loose statistics and loose comments. And I was hoping when I was listening the other night that, and I heard something that fired me up because I knew it was false. Mm-hmm. I was hoping that we'd catch that, and they do. They do. I think they've done a pretty good job in recent days, especially with the campaign. But, you know, once something gets into someone's mind and they feel, for example, that the new healthcare system may cause a huge deficit, and someone's told them that, and they can't remember who's told them that, and that's called source amnesia. They don't know why they know that, but they know it, and it must be true. And that's a lot of the negative ads contribute to that.
Well, and I guess this is a debate also within, you know, the journalism community, too. I mean, we have seen now, to use sort of the two polar examples, where Jim Lehrer got royally criticized for basically just letting the candidates take over the debate and do what they want. But then at the very next one, Candy Crowley also got roasted for doing the kind of instant kind of fact-checking or mm-hmm. assertion. And there was an argument about whether, you know, in that case, a journalist should be part of that process. Mm-hmm. I'll toss that one to Terry Jett. I mean, What is the responsibility there in terms of the fact-checking? And then I don't want us to get too deep in the weeds, because we can also have an argument about what actually constitutes a fact. And I don't think we want to get that metaphysical. But yeah. Terry Jett, I'll throw that one to you.
Well, I believe it's important for the voter to be able to understand what is truth, you know, or what is as close to truth that will help them make a decision as to what the, you know, the candidates are saying. In terms of the debate format, it's difficult to say. I mean, Candy Crowley was part of the town hall format, and so I believe she was trying to get things moving along so that the voters that were there that were supposed to pose questions were able to pose the questions. And, you know, Jim Lehrer was actually trying to just let it all, you know, sort of go and let the candidates say as much as possible, another way to give the public a chance to hear what the candidates actually stand for and what they mean. But the whole fact-checking thing to me is rather overwhelming. I think it's important, but if you're trying to keep up with everything that's said, every little minutia of the way that the candidates are saying things, and it becomes rather impossible, you really have to take the time yourself to look at what is important for you and to find out, you know, what really occurred or what is really the truth or validity of their statement.
Well, and some of that is also just the change in the way that we communicate now. I mean, it was a lot easier to do that when we were talking about newspapers, television, and radio, but now there are so many different ways for information to be disseminated. Does that add to the problem, Paul Manweiler?
Oh, I think it definitely does. You know, when you used to have three national broadcasting systems, that's where everybody got their news, that in the newspapers. And I think, I mean, I haven't seen the latest statistics, probably the professor and the author can tell us here, but I mean, I think that's, I mean, you just have to see the newspapers going out of business, the, you know, the whole sort of specter of people watch the TV station,
Newsweek
or,
going online,
or whatever they want, whatever they believe. Some people watch Fox, some people watch MSNBC. Mm-hmm. I'll sometimes flip back and forth, and you're getting two totally different presentations. I mean, MSNBC, during the Republican convention, they wouldn't show the speakers. They'd sit up there and criticize the speakers, and you'd never even hear the speaker. So that would be very one-sided. People believe Fox is the other way. And I think to go back to the fact check, I mean, I'd almost combine this back to the question right before about the deficit. You can fact check on certain things, but something like the deficit becomes so complex that everybody says a little bit of the truth probably in what they're saying. But, you know, the deficit is something that here a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate, and a Republican House came up with this program where we're going to have the fiscal cliff, and it's going to force us into action. Nobody was forced into action, and now everybody's denying that they did anything.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the U.S. Senate hasn't passed a budget in 3 years. The House has passed budgets. Everybody criticizes the House budgets for what they cut. Senate's getting away with murder because they don't pass a budget and they don't cut anything. They don't make anybody mad. So, I mean, I think, you know, when you look at these things, it's a difficult thing to have fact checking.
Well, and it comes into interpretation there
exactly.
Too. I suspect if I had, you know, John Gregg or somebody in here, his interpretation of that dynamic would be a little different.
Sure.
We are talking about what influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Dawn, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Your question,
I just
please.
Really more had a comment. It's not so much the issues for me as the general character of the candidates that are revealed. Like the example that we were using earlier, you know, a certain person has revealed himself to be really kind of arrogant and uncaring about a large part of the population. And, that kind of this thing is the thing that influences me more than necessarily any specific issue.
Thank you very much for the comment, Dawn.
Sure.
Thank you. Well, and is that, Terry Jett, I'll toss this to you for a quick comment. Is that something we sort of overlook, that sometimes people will vote for candidates that they disagree with just because they like them or they admire them?
Well, I want to go back to what I said in terms of people's socialization. I mean, you respond to candidates or just, you know, people largely based on who you are and where you come from. And so I actually am not sure which candidate she was referring to as uncaring or not compassionate. It might be that there are certain groups that person represents more so than others, or it may come across a certain way. It's really hard to kind of tell in the public arena how, you know, what's going on in terms of a way a person relates to people. So it really depends on who you are and how you respond to that person.
We are talking about what really influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Terry Jett, Paul Manweiler, and Audrey Borschell. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about what really influences voters. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And actually, we've gotten a comment from a listener named Jennifer on Facebook. Says really that what she would like to see out of candidates, and we can probably frame this as a way of how do we get to this end, if that's the case, is she would like to see less focusing on what the other person is doing wrong and more on what the candidate would do to solve the problem. I see Audrey Borschell nodding her head. I see Terry Jett nodding her head. I'll start with Audrey Borschell.
I believe that we're all struggling with the prospect of candidates not addressing the big issues, but they're skirting the issues, or they're tackling issues that are irrelevant to the big picture. And that's a problem, because we don't have any more information at the end than we did at the beginning of how they would address the financial crisis or how they would go after a foreign policy situation. And so we don't have any details, and that's what we're lacking on pretty much all candidates. They speak in generalities, and we need some specifics to be able to make up our minds and make good decisions.
Terry Jett, I'll let you have a crack at that one, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we do pride ourselves on desiring authenticity in the candidates, and yet we also pride ourselves on being a competitive society. Mm-hmm. And so we have to make a decision. And in order to make choices as to who's going to represent us versus, you know, one candidate versus the other, well, the candidate has to position themselves as how they are different from the other candidate. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is to, you know, cast that candidate as being someone that is unlikable or not likely to vote along the same interest as the voters. And so, yeah, it's difficult to present their own ideas without speaking to what the other candidate stands for.
I want to talk, Paul Manweiler, I'll throw this one to you. We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air about what role early voting might play in changing all of this. The fact that, you know, now, I mean, we're seeing news stories that they're beginning to try to predict the outcome in Ohio, which is, it seems like ground zero for the national election based on the early voting trends. Does that change the dynamic in any way?
Well, I think it's changed it dramatically. I mean, it used to be you wanted to peak on Election Day. You wanted your campaign to build until Election Day so that you were your strongest. And you might have lost a week before and you might have lost a week after, but Election Day was the important thing. With early voting, I mean, my understanding is many people voted before any of the debates began in several of these states. I saw a piece the other evening that people now are going in to vote early because they know then electronically both parties will know that they've already voted and they'll stop bugging them.
And leave them alone.
They'll stop calling them.
So
I think there's a lot of people that are going out just so the two parties will get off their back.
A defensive strategy.
Yeah.
There.
So, it's kind of interesting. With early voting, you make it easier for the voter, but, you know, were the issues crystallized before any of the debate started? I would argue not. You know, that's a very difficult thing, I think, on how do you handle this kind of campaign with this kind of early voting. And once again, we'll probably have studies immediately after this election that might say one of the candidates or the other won or lost because of early voting.
Or whether there were, you know, the other issue that has always struck me about early voting, which, you know, does, I think, open up the process, But what happens if, as you say, you cast your ballot before the debates and you hear something that changes your mind? Are there buyer's remorse provisions or anything like that? We are talking about what really influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your question, please.
I have two questions.
Okay.
First one is, how are the debate questions determined for any of the elections? And two, there's not been a whole lot of talk about gridlock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking gridlock after the election. Once the person's been elected, they're in the position, now it's time to do your job. How do we as voters figure out who can do that job best and avoid the gridlock? I mean, I heard for the last several years with, the Obama presidency that, news story after news story, there's gridlock. We can't get something passed. You know, the two parties don't agree. And that's huge to me, because it's like, I don't really care how good your plan is if you can't, get it through.
Thanks very much for the questions. We'll try to deal with them. Well, I'll throw that one to Terry Jett first, since we have someone from the Indiana Debate mm-hmm. Commission here who can answer. How does the Debate Commission determine which questions get asked, the people who show up at the debates and ask them?
Well, we try to go with the desires of the public, and so the public actually sends questions in to the Debate Commission, and then we go through the questions trying to gather what issues are most important, and we invite actually a lot of the people that bring the questions in to present the question themselves to the candidates. We also try to vet the questions to make sure that the questions are not leaning towards one side or the other, that they provide a vehicle for both or all three candidates actually, or whoever participates, to be able to express their best ideas. And so that's, there's a vetting process, and I believe it's probably the same way at the national level. And I will add that the Indiana Debate Commission is the only state-level debate commission in this country. So a lot of other states are actually looking to our example, because I think we are doing good work to allow the public to really ask the questions directly to the candidate. Can I speak to the other issue of gridlock?
Yeah,
and that's important. She's bringing up a very important issue, in that it's not only about the candidates, it's themselves, but it's about the political parties being able to have civil discussions and to dialogue and to listen and be open to the other's ideas. And you can't have that happen when on the day that someone's actually elected, that there's a declaration that you're going to just do everything that you can to prevent that person from being reelected without anything actually even taking place as far as policy discussions. So we have to move beyond our own biases and differences in that way, look to the issues at hand. We have a lot of things that have to be addressed in this country, and to have these sort of divisive politics mm-hmm. taking place, it does us all a disservice.
Well,
so it's important.
And let me throw that to Paul Manweiler as the former elected official. When were you first elected to office, Paul?
The first election was
1980. And I guess as a journalist of some tenure myself, there is, I think, something that has changed in the process, in that the campaigns now are pretty much perpetual. They never shut down. Mm-hmm. There at least was a period early in my career when there would be a honeymoon, there would be a period when you dealt with business and then everybody ramped up and ran again. But now it's like you never stand down. Is that assessment valid, and then how has that changed things?
Oh, I think that assessment is very valid. When I first was involved in the Indiana House, I mean, the campaigns were a couple of thousand dollars in a district. Now this time we're going to – I know there's a well over $1 million Senate race, state Senate race here in Indianapolis, because of TV costs, because of TV time. The special interests are much more involved, whether you like it or not, on both sides. So I think the gridlock has come from a couple of things. It's come from very polarization almost within the public, which mm-hmm. is then reflected in the elected officials. You had, you know, the first 2 years of the Obama administration, you had overwhelming Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. There wasn't gridlock because mm-hmm. the party felt they had to produce certain things. You know, the last 2 years, then you had the 2010 election. The Republicans were swept in. I can't remember. They picked up 60 seats or something. Mm-hmm. That was obviously a message from the Republican standpoint. People don't want what they had. Mm-hmm. We need to do something different. But when you've got a Democratic Senate and a Democratic president, you can't do that. But I think that comes from a couple of things. One, mm-hmm. the elections anymore, mm-hmm. The districts are so almost one-sided mm-hmm. that
the
a Democrat who might cross over and work with a Republican and a Republican who might cross over and work with a Democrat, the Democrat's going to get thrown out in the primary because they're not liberal enough or not far enough mm-hmm. on some of the issues. The Republican's going to lose maybe from the right side because they worked with the other party. And consequently, you get two parties and two groups of elected officials that the message to them from the electorate is, you need to stand the line more on our principles. So it gets difficult to find that middle ground.
Well, and we've sort of seen that here, at least with Indiana Senate seats. I mean, we had two moderate members of the U.S. Senate in Evan Bayh and Richard Lugar, and Bayh left voluntarily, although some of the polling data suggests that he could have some political trouble, saying that, you know, that the atmosphere was toxic because of this. And Lugar faced the sort of scenario that you've talked about where, you know, because he was perceived as being too cooperative with members of the other mm-hmm. party, his party ran a challenger in a primary and knocked him out. What does that do to the process, Terry Chett?
Well, yeah, it's very disruptive, actually, you know, because there's unknown factors that are thrown into the process. And it was kind of sad to see actually both senators, leave, one on their own accord and one, you know, not so much, because Senator Lugar was a senior statesman and had done a lot for the state of Indiana and was someone that was able to reach across the aisle with great results. And so we have the unknown factor there in the Republican candidate that's replaced him. And then, you know, Senator Bayh, you know, somewhat would offer left too soon, although it was understandable. He was on to something mm-hmm. in terms of the lack of civility that was taking place.
We are talking about what really influences voters here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Welcome to the program, Becky.
Hello, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have what influences me more than anything else, and I'm a 74-year-old woman, and I've been voting a long time, is the political platforms, not necessarily the leader of that particular party or in our Senate or in our state or at the federal government. And my observations, and I have no basis for them other than what people tell me about their particular party, but mm-hmm. they don't speak to the platform. They speak more to the elements. And I was wondering if the political parties have a platform, a Bill of Rights or a Constitution. Are there do they have platform boundaries that they're not able to go past in for civility reasons? And why aren't candidates speaking more about their platforms and what they really represent rather than what they really mean to say, rather than all this nonsense and the negativity of what the other person? I think that what's happening is we're separating the horse from the cart mm-hmm. and expecting a reasonable connection. And I'd like to, is there something written, a platform written by both parties that we could read and decide for ourselves?
Okay.
I feel the diplomacy and human interest is part of the Democratic platform. And I feel that taxes and power represent the Republican platform. And I believe that they could really communicate well together if they followed their platform.
Thank you very much for the call, Becky. We'll take it up. Thank you. Well, that issue, you know, to some degree, she's talking about, you know, is there a brand, basically, for the parties or their constituencies that they they speak to, and is that written down somewhere where people can study it? Most campaigns, and parties at their conventions do come up with a platform, right, Paul Manweiler?
Yeah, there would be a state Republican platform, a Democratic state platform. Nationally, both conventions adopt a Republican and Democrat platform. My guess is...
And most of them are certified cures for insomnia.
Yeah, my guess is less than 0.1% have ever read either one. And my other guess would be both of them are so mealy-mouthed that you don't really know what they say. Because a platform is something basically to put out that would not offend anyone, I think, on both sides.
Well, and that speaks to one of the other things.
I mean, there were a couple of changes this time in the Democratic National Convention when Obama presidential electors decided there were some things that just were going to stick out and we have to change this one or two words. I think they were both voted down on the floor by verbal votes, shouting votes, but both recorded as being changed.
Well, and Terry Jett, over time, also the parties, the constituencies they serve, the Democratic Party used to be the states' rights party, for example, and the Republican Party opposed them. Now they've sort of flip-flopped on that. Is that part of the confusion as well?
Yes, it could be, but I think if people actually pay attention to the convention and actually, she's right, go online and read the platforms and they can see what the parties stand for. And then also look at, the policies that come through the legislature and who authors them and, who is a part of what committees and, the values and the ideas that they represent. Then you can get a good sense of what they stand for. But then there's also the media interpretation, which I believe our author can speak to.
Yeah. Audrey Bourchel, please.
And as far as the media interpretation, I know that when the health care plan came down, I didn't get any information specifically in the newspaper until the very end, and then not enough. And so perhaps for all of these bills and situations that occur, we need a lot more information divulged in media. It's just not going to be very boring to hear about the medical plan. It's going to be very instructive. It's important for us to find out what's in it so that either we accept it or reject it. And I think for most people, it was a lot of confusion.
How much of this we've got?
I'm going to say this might be a rare opportunity for me to defend the media, but I don't know if the congressman necessarily knew what was in it until they were voting on it. So how could the media report that weeks before or even a day before? I mean, it basically came together once they knew they had the votes, which were Democratic votes in the House, Democratic votes in the Senate. They had to make sure they had the votes within their caucus. Then all of a sudden the bill was passed and... I don't think the media could have reported anything even the day before.
And that's often the dynamic even at the state level.
Yeah,
with
the state
budget
too,
where you get this massive document a few hours before the vote, there's no way anyone can read it all.
And I guess in defense of the political process now, until people are faced with that last second they have to vote yes or no, they always, I would like a little bit of change on this, I'd like this to be changed, and until you get to that point... until you've got 51 votes, whether the Republican and Democrat votes or just one party, that's part of the problem.
But to become an informed...
Yes, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will be back next week. Thank you for joining us for this Indiana Public Broadcasting Station program.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.